This time we're in Lexington, Nebraska, the home of KRVN 50,000 watts on 880. And we're just approaching this four-tower directional array in a cornfield, and we're about to meet with Gary Rice, transmitter engineer, who will give us a tour of this plant.
It's all owned by farmers and ranchers. It was started that way in the early 50s. They went on the air February 1st of 1951. And today,
on 1010
at 25 kilowatt, it's a cooperative. You pay $10 to join, but you never get any dividends back. The only thing you get is a free meal at the Vets Club every year. And they elect a board of directors.
At the annual meeting.
Yeah, at the annual meeting, and they elect a board of directors, and the profits, because it's a Type S corporation, the profits have to be plowed right back into the, because it pays no dividends, it has to be plowed right back into the operation.
When did you go 50,000 watts on 80?
In 1968 is when they started construction, and they had originally started at 1010 with 25 kilowatts, so that transmitter only ran half power all of its life. It was a daytime only, and obviously they could double the power and increase the coverage area, and that's what they wanted.
KRVN is one of the stations that ended up on a clear channel frequency. Originally, WCBS was alone on 880, I believe.
Yeah, WCBS was a clear channel, and then in the early to mid-60s, the government started allowing, the FCC started allowing stations. But the station who occupied that frequency got to determine what the protection null had to be, et cetera, et cetera.
And the clear channel proceeding, the whole idea was to provide some wide area service to the western part of the United States. And so the allocations that were made, I think, in fact, Nebraska is about the farthest east. Most of them were in the far west states.
Yeah, that's correct.
Nebraska got 880, and you weren't the only applicant, I take it, right?
No. There was another station in Grand Island, KMMJ, and they had the original had originally won the fight for the 880 allocation, but WCBS didn't think that they could deliver the null protection that they demanded with a three-tower array, so that threw it back open again. KRVN went in with a four-tower array, quarter-wave tower array, and WCBS bought that, and KRVN ended up with the allocation after spending a lot of lawyer fees.
So at night, at local sunset, you're required to switch, and it's not a question of just sending the signal west, but the main reason you're doing it is to protect the WCBS signal to the east, right?
Yeah, that's right. If you look down on top of the towers and could see the RF, it would be basically a heart-shaped pattern without the point at the bottom. It would just be a very blunt. And under the original rules, we had to maintain a zero null off 81 degrees, and if 81 degrees takes you right through New York City and obviously protecting WCBS.
What do you mean by zero null?
We are allowed virtually no signal in that heading.
From the east of the towers?
Right. And that was commonly called a critical array. There's very few of them in the United States. But now they have changed the rules again, and we're under the process of getting rid of our critical array designation and going to a standard type array, and we're in the process of that. We have a construction permit right now with permission to operate at vary the parameters.
And the idea is to be able to let the signal out a little.
Yeah,
a little
we're going to we're gonna little bit let a little bit more RF back to the east, and hopefully serve our customers and listeners in that area. As I mentioned, this whole operation is owned by farmers and ranchers, and we have a lot of listeners to the east, clear back to the Missouri River and beyond, but unfortunately at night we go away.
You can hear this thing on the west coast.
Well, yeah, when you're pumping 50 kilowatt
to
Malibu Beach, yeah, we've gotten signal reports from Hawaii, Australia, New Zealand. You want to go back to the phasing room?
Now, we're standing in a room that is populated by a lot of big coils that are anywhere from a foot and a half to 3 feet long and two, maybe foot and a half in diameter.
Yep, about right.
And they're made out of tubing?
Yeah, silver-plated copper tubing. Those are the coils, and of course the large vacuum and ceramic capacitors are for towers 2 and 3. Most of the power goes into towers 2 and 3. Towers 1 and 4, that's why those components are smaller. Those are ribbon wire inductors and obviously smaller glass vacuum capacitors. But because of the amount of power that's being run into towers 2 and 3, that's why those components are larger than the other components.
So this wall I'm looking at actually alters the electrical signal, the time it's delayed in the time it takes to get to each tower. And then in combination, the different towers are fed electrically slightly different. And the combination together makes this whole thing act kind of like a column loudspeaker, doesn't it? It forces the energy in one direction.
Yeah, that's correct. And if you set up two towers, quarter wave towers, and set them half wave length apart, you come up with and split the power evenly, you come up with a certain type of pattern. And if you feed them quarter wave length apart in spacing, they will have the opposite pattern.
On 880, a quarter wavelength is how many feet?
It's about 300.
Those towers out there are about 300 feet high.
They're about 311 feet, actually. And you'll see if you go out in the tower houses, which we can go out a little bit later, you'll see the same basic components in there. But those components out there in the tower houses have no effect on pattern operation. That's strictly an antenna matching operation.
They're called what, antenna tuning units?
Yeah, ATUs, antenna tuning units, and that's to match from 50 ohms up to whatever the base impedance of the particular tower requires. And of course, the more towers you mix in, the more they affect each other, so you'll get some pretty squirrely mutual impedances.
And the whole thing is a mathematical formula that if I walked over here now and started to turn one of these adjustments, I could make the signal move literally in a different direction.
And it doesn't take very much movement, very much component movement. Just standing here, you can see the change on the antenna monitor, just your body capacitance alone. So whenever we adjust this, then we step out of the room. This is a copper screen enclosed room. And if you adjust anything, then you have to step back out and let it settle, because your body capacitance alone will be enough to mess
sure.
things up.
Now, this is always fun. And for those of you who are sighted, you have probably seen this trick with a fluorescent light bulb, holding it near something generating a lot of RF.
Yeah, the
you won't have to get very close, I bet.
No, the kids that come out here, they're really opens their eyes. A standard burned out 4-foot fluorescent tube, and you just bring it up next to the right now daytime array we're feeding tower 3. Just bring it up to the tower 3 components, and as you can see, it's fully lit while I'm holding it in my hand. The kids get a big bang out of that. Okay, we'll go back in the bomb shelter. These are 24-inch thick concrete reinforced walls with the same ceiling, and you notice it's kind of an L dog leg coming in here, and there's an outside door that's the same way. Yeah. Now, this is for radiation split travels in short and straight lines only, and you notice come back here, we've got dried beans and popcorn and instant potatoes and peanut butter, and you're supposed to be able to live back here, at least under the old EBS rules. You're supposed to be able to live back here for 2 weeks. So that was the theory behind this. That's why we got all the water up there with a little drop of Clorox in each jug. And then we have full transmitter control from in here, as well as out at the main operating console in the control room out there.
So you could run the radio station from here?
We have an old RCA board in here. It used to be a production board circa 1951.
You could be a disc jockey again, Gary.
Yeah, we've got a few records back here. But
you've got two-way radios here? And
we've got a ham rig here. It's tied in with the Dawson County EOC and the sheriff's office and the studio, and it's all tied together.
And this all goes back to the original mission of this station when it was put on the air. We need a way to communicate with the farmers.
Right. That was the purpose of the whole thing, and like I said, you know, the main thing is that it's on the air.
So it is really a lifeline. If something happens from a local, a county-level disaster to a tornado to a national disaster, we've got communications capability here to keep this thing running.
Well, Nebraska is a sparsely populated state, particularly in the western and northern part of the state, and those folks up there don't have local radio stations, so they depend on this one. And, of course, with the ground conductivity being poor up in the sand hills and everything, it takes a big horse that they can hear.
It's interesting, folks, if you have never heard this station, to listen to their weather forecast, because they're one of the few stations that still covers, what, 5-6 states in every forecast?
Yeah, we do eastern Colorado, Wyoming, Nebraska, Kansas, and And once in a while we get into South Dakota, not too much. But, yeah, it sometimes gets rather involved. The weather forecast could be 5-6 minutes long.
They're also religious about doing station IDs. And if I stood here for another 30 seconds, I could almost point to the time when the station break would come.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that sets you apart from a lot of stations nowadays.
Yeah.
They take pride in their license, which is unusual this day and age.
So this building has been here since...
They built the south part of the building in 68, and then when the generator was put in, this addition to the building, the bomb shelter and all that was added. Now you notice the kitchen and the little utility room, which is a wash pit and hot water heater, but you'll notice that the high-pressure water tank is fiberglass, not steel. And there is so much RF around here, you set up a process called electrolysis, and it will eat. And we generate enough ozone around here that you can't lay a pair of overboots out here over a year or two and they'll disintegrate. We have the same problem with the motor mounts in the voltage regulators for the MW50 transmitter. About every 4 to 5 years, those rubber pieces inside those motor mounts will disintegrate, and then it wipes out the worm drive. You know,
just from the RF signal being generated by the plant.
The rubber damage is from the ozone that's generated here. You got to remember, you're pumping 52,000 watts out to the antenna system, you know.
Now we're in the generator room. You don't want to start this.
Well, it's a little deepening, you know. You're not going to hear anything in the tape, but it's a V12 cat with dual turbos. It was provided by FEMA, Federal Emergency Management, and it was a used generator when they found it. I think it had like 600 hours on it. It was up in the sand hills, and it ran a bunch of center pivots up there for 1 year or 2 years or whatever.
He's talking about irrigation systems.
Yeah, large pivot irrigation systems, deep well irrigation. The FEMA provided the generator and the underground fuel tanks. Now, we took one of them out, so we're only down to one tank, underground tank. But there's a 5,000-gallon tank buried here on the north side of the building, north side of the driveway. So this thing is instant start the minute it senses a loss of commercial power, either on three-phase or just a single phase. It will start. We have electric block heaters that feed it all the time.
Do you test it regularly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we normally fire it about once every month or two just to make sure we're...
Gary, I guarantee you there's somebody listening to this tape right now that would love to hear this thing crank over. I'm putting him on the spot, folks. I think he's going to resist.
Well, we could do it, but, you know, I'd rather not.
It's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll
it's
take your word for it.
It's a V12 cat, and it makes a lot of noise. Yeah. In fact, is you should wear ear protection when you're in here.
I'm sure, yeah.
The floor shakes.
You're going to hear a little bit of interference on this part of the tape. What that is the 50,000-watt RF signal getting into our tape recorder. Let's get going on our tour with engineer Gary Rice.
This was kind of a swamp to begin with, and then there's a large pit on the south side of it, and they took some of the dirt out of there and built it up a little bit so that the tower bases would be, you know, up out of the water, so... But largely a gumbo low area. And
there's copper in the ground.
Yes, there's 120 buried copper radials that are slightly longer than the towers are high, and then there's 120 also shorter radials, and then it's all bonded together. Wherever they all interlap, they're all silver soldered together, and then we have a 4-inch ground strap that runs out to the array, and then, of course, each tower pedestal, there's a 4-inch strap that ties all of them together.
And the copper out here is buried down, what, half?
I don't know what they did originally, but right now it's basically 6 to 8 inches. I don't know if it was ever that deep to begin with. But,
and those of you who have been DXAS listeners for a while will remember our tutorial that Augie Prestel did for us, reminding us that to make an antenna work, you have to have two components, the part above the ground and the part in the ground system, and that's what Gary's describing.
Yeah, that's typical AM array. Obviously, you don't have that on television or FM or anything like that, but it's they're a vertical antenna, and you have to have the other half of the cycle. Basically, the ground system is the mirror image. It's the same as putting a CB antenna on the top of the car, and if you want optimum performance, you want it in the middle of the roof so it has an equal ground plane around the entire antenna. And what we did when we built these, we put 100 foot together on the ground, which is basically about where the first side obstruction lights are. And an eye welded, in an AM tower, you don't rely on strictly a bolt and nut connection. Each section is welded after it's been bolted together.
Did we say these are usually, what, 20-foot sections going up there?
Yeah, 20 or 25, depending on the manufacturer. And they're solid leg towers. They're not hollow leg, and everyone's quite heavy. And we put the first 100 foot together on the ground. I welded the connections wherever the sections are bolted together, and then we stood it with a crane and put the first set of guys on, and then used from the 100-foot level up to the 311-foot level. Those were all stacked, and then we also took the welder up at a portable welder, and we took the welder up and welded each leg. The whole tower stands on this ceramic base insulator, and it is hollow. It's got about a 3-inch hole, and it's filled with oil. And you see the pin, it sets on a saddle, and if you lose a guy wire, the whole thing's going to fall over.
Just tip over.
Yeah, but the whole thing, and the reason for that is that tower can walk. If a tower doesn't move, it's like an airplane wing. The tower has to move. And so this whole thing basically sets on a pin a little bit larger than your thumb. And then, of course, the guys is what keeps it stable. And to plumb the tower, to make it straight up and down, you take a transit and you shoot it two different ways and go up and down the tower, and you just adjust the turnbuckles on the guy wires.
So the tower is actually rotating freely?
It won't twist, really, but it'll sit there and rock ever so slightly. You can't see it. Now, of course, when you get to the top, they're moving a foot or two up there in a windy day. Another thing that's unusual about this, and a lot of stations are going to, you notice that most AM stations that you see have insulators in the guy wires, and of course, if you look, the only place we've got an insulator is right at the tower. Well, and when we got hit by that tornado in 93, we changed all of our, we lost towers 1, 2, and 3. 4 is the only original tower left. When we put up the new towers, we went to a Kevlar guy system, which is the same thing that a bulletproof vest is made out of. But that's why we don't have to have the insulators in the guy wire to break up the resonant frequencies. You know,
so they're not metal guy. They're not metallic
they're
guy wires.
They're plastic guy wires. That's correct. I think they're 5/16, as I remember. You can get by with smaller cable using Kevlar. Kevlar is twice as strong as steel.
Your guide at three levels, too,
yeah,
it looks
basically
like.
Basically, about 100 foot is where the first one is, and then we've got about 25 foot of tower sticking above the top guy yet.
I did notice they're all just straight as can be when you line up and you look on either way. Well, they don't all look that way. And if I look in that direction, I'm looking right at New York City.
Yeah, if you line them all up, you get out on the highway out here, and you line them up and to where you only see one tower, and you took an airplane and flew that heading, you'd go right through New York City.
KRVN is also unusual in the size of some of this hardware. The typical antenna tuning unit at the base of a tower might be a box 4 or 5 feet square, but this is a room we're in now that's about 10 by 12.
Yeah, basically the same size of components as what was in the tower, in the phasing room. And again, all copper screen, ceiling, floor, walls, everything's tied together. Everything's tied into 4-inch copper strap. And we're standing in Tower 3, which is also the daytime tower. And so we have a tuning unit that operates, and that's what those switches are. Operates in the daytime array, and then it switches for the nighttime. So you have a switch in the phasing room and then one for each tower houses. There's 5 switches that have to make before the transmitter will come back up in online.
And we'll hear that tonight. We'll hear what it sounds like on the air. 8:45, is that the?
Yeah, 8:44, actually. But
and they'll do it right on time, folks.
Well, pretty close, yeah. So that's basically what it looks like. And, of course, you know, the old static drain there with the fluorescent bulb. You know, you can come in here in the dead of night, and you can kind of see what's going on until you find the light switch. But this is our line out coming from the phasing room. And what we're running right now is 31 amps, just like we're supposed to be running into the base of the tower. Coming out to the out of the tower house, we come through a 6-inch glass bowl insulator, and we have a 3/4-inch copper pipe, and that's welded directly to the base of the tower, about 6 inches above the base plate. If you notice, there's 2 sets of ball caps
I did see that.
Yeah, one is for the tower power, the light power feed, and the other one's for the RF feed. And of course, depending on how much power you run into each tower will determine how close those balls are set together. And I've stood up by the building just before a thunderstorm gets here, and you'll hear like it sounds like a .22 rifle going
cracking,
off. And what it is static discharging off the tower, you know. But
sorry we can't hear that today, folks, but
yeah,
it's just not dry enough out here.
I don't like to stand out here when it's doing that.
I would think you'd get nervous. Yeah. You mentioned the 93 tornado that came through here. You were on the air broadcasting emergency information, warning people that this was coming, and then bang-o, you guys got hit.
Yeah, right. There wasn't anybody out here at the transmitter site at the time. It was about, I think, 11 or 12 o'clock at night, as I remember. And, of course, we had been broadcasting the weather warnings and everything, and I think I was asleep at home. I know I got woke up. Jim came out and walked in. Of course, there was no power. Generator was running, but we didn't have tower lights. We didn't have building lights. We didn't have anything. Transmitter's off the air. Generator's running like it's supposed to. It's automatic start. And they grabbed the flashlight, walked up to the transmitter, and looked at it, and saw some water on the floor, looked up, and the roof was gone. About a third of the building roof was completely gone, and the transmitters were soaked in water. And so he just went back, shut the generator off, called the boss and said, we're going to have to look at this at daylight. And I don't remember now if Jim knew that Tower 2 was laying on the ground at that point or not, but we think it broke a guy wire, one of the Northwest guys on Tower 2, and Tower 2 was laying on the ground. They called me yet that night and said, be there bright-eyed and bushy-tailed or whatever at daylight or before, and we walked in, and you know, it was a complete and utter disaster. But by 11 o'clock in the morning, we had the standby transmitter on the air, and we were off 11 hours. And about it was like 12 days later, we got hit again.
Did you say you lost three of these towers in that?
Well, Tower 2 was on the ground that morning, and then we got a tower crew in here from Wyoming. And towers 1 and 3 had twists in them. They wouldn't even climb them, and I don't blame them. The towers 1, 2, and 3 were all heavily damaged, and 2 was laying on the ground. We got a replacement for tower 2, and fortunately we have a spare feed line that goes out to tower 2. We basically fed a full 50 kilowatt in once we got tower 2 replaced, and used that as our daytime array, and of course we had to go off the air at night. We did run down around 10 kilowatt for, I think, 30 days. But after that period was over with, we were off the air at night until we got towers 1 and 3 replaced. Yeah, it was a mess.
We're back in the main transmitter room. We're standing in a dance hall, actually, that probably was once fully occupied by a transmitter.
Yeah, it was RCA BT50F took up the whole south wall, and as you can see now, it's gone.
The new solid-state transmitter is about 6 feet high and, 9 feet long, maybe?
Yeah, 9 or 10.
About 2.5 feet deep, and the old one was probably 40 feet in total length.
Yeah, closer to 60, I think,
really?
Yeah. Yeah, and the neat thing about this, we've got a thermometer back here on the back. Ambient air temperature only increases 2 degrees. That's how thermally efficient it is.
Gary, thank you so much.
You bet, my pleasure.
Well, a nice visit at the KRVN transmitter plant with engineer Gary Rice. And we learned some new things about high-power broadcasting. Well, let's see what happens. It's just about 8:44 as we have left the station, and we're heading east. And as circumstance would have it, we are almost on a line between KRVN and New York City as we travel east on 80. And we're about 110 miles east of the station right now. We remember that their local sunset is 8:44. Let's see what happens.
That's why I'm following you. Ooh, on my own. Should I wander through this wonderland alone? Never knowing my right foot from the left, my head from my gloves off. I'm misty to the chin left. Too much in love.
KRVN Lexington just got word a few seconds ago that the Kansas City Royals game against the Tigers in Detroit has been called. We're going to head over there for post-game now. After 3.5 innings, that game has been called.
This is the Kansas City Royals Radio Network. Royals Baseball is brought to you in part by your Cub Cadet retailer, where you can register for the Royals Mow 'em Down inning.
The Kansas City Royals.
Live demo of the directional pattern of KRVN in Lexington, Nebraska. More fun out here touring these stations, and we'll continue that from time to time on the DX Audio Service.